Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Today I'm speaking with Amishi Jha. Amishi is a professor of psychology at the University of Miami, and she serves as the director of contemplative neuroscience for the Mindfulness Research and Practice Initiative, which she co-founded in 2010. She received her PhD from the University of California, Davis, and did postdoctoral training at the Brain Imaging and Analysis Center at Duke University. Amishi's work has been featured at NATO and the World Economic Forum and the Pentagon. She's been covered in the New York Times, NPR, Time Magazine, Forbes, etc. And her TED Talk, titled How to Tame Your Wandering Mind, has been viewed over 5 million times. And she's the author of the book Peak Mind. We focus mostly on attention and the brain. We discuss how attention is studied, the failure of brain training games, the relationship between attention and awareness, mindfulness as an intrinsic mental capacity, the neurological implications of different types of training in meditation, the neural correlates of attention and distraction, the prospects of self-transcendence, the link between thought and emotion, the difference between dualistic and non-dualistic mindfulness, how we might study non-dual awareness in the lab, the influence of smartphones, the value of mind wandering, and other topics. And now I bring you Amishi Jha. I am here with Amishi Jha. Amishi, thanks for joining me.
Very happy to be here, Sam.
So tell our audience what you have focused on scientifically and academically up to now.
Sure. So I am a neuroscientist. I'm a cognitive neuroscientist. And the work I do in my lab is focused on understanding how the brain's attention system functions, what makes it fail and makes it vulnerable, and as it relates to mental training and mindfulness, what we can do to strengthen it. So a lot of our effort has been kind of shifting over the years from more the basic mechanisms of how attention operates to understanding the factors that we must consider in trying to strengthen it and protect it, especially for groups for whom attention can be a matter of life and death. I mean, in some sense, that's all of us. But particular professions like emergency services folks, military service members, medical and nursing professionals, truly their lapses could mean grave consequences for others.
Yeah. Yeah. So what tools do you use to study attention at the level of the brain?
Yeah. So we use functional MRI and EEG, as well as with most of our work sort of out in the field, so to speak, we're doing behavioral measures with various cognitive tasks, as well as a whole battery of sort of subjective or self-report metrics.
Let's bring in your interest in mindfulness and meditation. How did you come by that, and what has been your level of exploration there personally, and you know what teachers or traditions have been important to you?
Right. So the answer is sort of in two parts, the personal journey and the professional or actually research-related journey. And of course, they intersect at multiple points. As I mentioned, you know, most of my training as a cognitive neuroscientist was really in the basic mechanism. So just figure out, which is not a simple thing, but figure out how it works. And I started getting a little bit antsy around this because what we were finding repeatedly that my advisors had already known was that this system of the brain is extremely powerful. So much so that I'll refer to it as the brain's boss, because we know that wherever it is that we devote our attention will modify almost the entirety of the computational functioning of the brain. It can bias it in very, very profound ways. So if it is this boss, I started getting excited in my early years as an assistant professor. That was at the University of Pennsylvania on what we could do to perturb attention. And that meant doing all kinds of fun things in the lab, like bringing in undergrads and having them do attentionally demanding tasks and then sort of messing with them in kind and IRB approved ways. So either negative mood inductions or psychosocial threat, you know, telling them that they're not doing as well as other folks, stressing them out in various ways. And repeatedly and reliably, we saw that their attention failed them. So we started getting a picture of all the ways in which you could perturb attention. And that, of course, led to devastating consequences for the normal ways in which attention could bias information processing. And that's what, from the laboratory perspective, got me extremely curious and I would say desperate to find some way in which we might train attention. So this was the early 2000s. And at that point, sort of two things were happening. In the cognitive neuroscience literature, there was a proliferation of studies on brain training approaches, right? So these simple brain, simple behavioral tasks that people play as games and seeing if we can actually strengthen functioning. And even at that point, now it's sort of been very much clarified that this is a problematic approach because you get better at the game, but not much else. Mm. There's many, I think, very well-intentioned enterprises that have, and then many researchers that have tried to do this in their laboratories. But the problem was you'd get better and better at the game, but then when you shifted even the most subtle aspects of the perceptual input or the task demands, you were kind of back to square one. Mm. So we weren't seeing that there's some core strengthening of attention as a general resource. And so we tried other things like light and sound or technology facilitated things. And now people have gotten much more sophisticated with, you know, direct current stimulation, et cetera. Nothing was really working. I was not finding that anything was able to, in a sustained way, benefit attentional functioning. So that's sort of happening in my lab, in my pursuit of trying to understand how to strengthen attention in the face of these sort of potent kryptonite factors that disable it. In my personal life, as a young assistant professor who had just had her first kid, I was battling a lot of what can happen with a multitude of demands and trying to be the best I could be in all the roles that I played in my life. And I found that I just could not keep hold of my own attention. And it was this very sort of ironic realization. It's like, this is all I study. This is what I do in the lab. Mm. Yet I am just all over the place. I'm not aware of what's happening. And it got to the point, especially as it related to my family, that I felt like it was unacceptable. And there was one moment that I remember trying to read my then, I don't know, toddler, a book. And at some point in the middle of, this is a book I read, and you have children, right? I mean, just you read the same book over, over and over and over again, to the point where, you know, I could tell you the words on the next page. But at some point so we've read this book multiple times as a bedtime story. And at some point in the middle of the story one night, he sort of stops me and he asks me something about what's on the page. And I had absolutely no idea. It's like I was completely going through the motions. Mm. And that made me very, very, I don't know, I felt very tender about it. Like, this is him as a toddler. I mean, if I'm starting to miss things now, what about when he really, really needs me? And it was a wake-up call in my life of like, I got to figure out how to pay better attention. And so I went sort of on a personal hunt, trying to see if there's anything in the literature, in the scientific literature of like, okay, look, maybe there's something I missed, right? These brain training games we know aren't really working, or technology solutions aren't working. There's not really a lot of evidence that there's anything. And through a series of sort of fortuitous events, one having to do with Richie Davidson visiting Penn at that same period of time, mm-hmm. in the spring of the semester, I was having all these things. And he gave a talk sort of in his standard affective neuroscience talk, you know, because this was so early on in the whole mindfulness, I don't know, explosion of literature. He didn't even talk about or mention anything about the meditation work he was doing. But at the end of his talk, he showed this kind of now very often seen image, but at that point it was pretty novel. A brain that had been induced to be in a negative state and showing this sort of functional MRI brain activation profile. And right next to it, one that was induced to be in a positive state. And, you know, he did this basically by having people remember autobiographical memories that were either positive or negative. And what was his point was essentially, look how distinct these are, mm-hmm. that we can put the brain in these affective states and they're different from each other. But given what was going on in my life, at the end of the talk, I raised my hand and I basically was like, how do you get that brain, pointing to the negative one, to look like that brain, the positive one? And he, almost a little bit in a flippant way, said, meditation. And that was sort of the close of the session. And, you know, and I was sort of like, what? I'd never, ever heard anybody use that term in a context like that. And you know,
what's your background, Amishi?
I was just going to tell you. Yeah. So my background is as an Indian woman. You know, of course, I'd heard about meditation. I mean, it was like my earliest memories are my parents meditating. So this is something I knew very much as part of the cultural landscape of my personal life. But frankly, for a lot of reasons, which we can choose to go into if we want, I had completely rejected it. To shorthand it, essentially, I was not interested in anything at that point that I thought was not serious, like a serious endeavor that could have some basis in science. But the second part was that the culture itself, I felt, had a lot of sexism and other things that I didn't feel were welcoming to me and who I was. And so I just kind of rejected the whole thing outright.
Yeah.
So in some sense, like I had already had like a thing against meditation from my personal background. And then here is this affective neuroscientist who I admire and, you know, I really respect. And he's saying this term and I couldn't kind of square the two. So at some point later on in his visit, we had a chance to sit down and talk about what he'd been up to. And that opened me up a bit. Like, okay, given what he's starting to find with the, you know, adept monastics regarding some of the structural and functional changes they were seeing, I opened up my curiosity and took a walk down to the Penn bookstore and started kind of browsing through the section on meditation. And I got very, very fortunate that the book I ended up picking was Jack Kornfield's Meditation for Beginners. Mm-hmm. And committed to kind of checking it out and reading it and started doing some of the practices. It came at that point with the CD, which my children don't even know what that is. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it really started making a difference. And it was a real aha moment where I realized that, oh my goodness, the thing that I've been doing in these practices quietly by myself every day, which is essentially a foundational, one of the things was essentially a mindfulness of the breath practice of focus your attention on breath-related sensations, notice when the mind wanders, and when you do, return it back, that this activity was very much tied to what I was desperately looking for within my lab, an approach that may help to protect and strengthen attention. So after maybe 6 months, I said, that's it. I'm going to try to figure out what's going on here and bring these tools that I'm personally practicing, put them to a strong test, and wrote my first NIH grant on exploring the effect of mindfulness meditation on attention. And then I've sort of haven't stopped since. So that sort of brings together the journey of the personal and the professional.
Nice, nice. And so when did you first start publishing on mindfulness and attention?
2007.
So your interest in all of this, it's perhaps surprising to realize that all of this precedes what the smartphone has done to everybody's life, right? I mean, it's amazing. When we think about a crisis of attention now and a war being fought for our attention, I think the first thing people think of now, I mean, really at the front lines of this battle is the computer they're carrying around in their pockets. But obviously, this has been a problem for thousands of years, and everything right. The Buddha recommended was appropriate to a scattered human mind 2,500 years ago. But let's define a few terms. How do you define attention? How would you differentiate it from mindfulness? And
sure. How
do you think about these, both of those things in relation to consciousness or awareness, which I use as synonyms?
All three.
So go for attention, mindfulness, and just that the basic faculty of consciousness / awareness / sentience.
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to dig in on how that relates to what I'll tell you what in my view of attention. So the main thing about attention is that it really, if we think about its sort of evolutionary purpose, right, or how it became something that we all possess in our own minds, to solve a big computational problem that the brain suffered from, that there was just far more information in the environment than could be fully processed in any one moment. So the notion of selecting a subset of what one is experiencing for full interrogation using the full computational power of the brain, you know, whether it's in much less sophisticated organisms than the human brain, makes sense to me. And from the kind of standard cognitive neuroscience perspective, attention in its selection ability isn't one thing, but at least three things. And we could, you know, probably laundry list even more, but the three ways in which we pay attention really guide and connect to your second part of your question regarding mindfulness. So the first system of attention is really regarding sort of selective focus or selection, content-based privileging of some information at the exclusion of other information. And that prioritizing and privileging in the brain, we know, shows up as biased information processing in favor of what we pay attention to. So this would be something like the brain's orienting system, as well as aspects of what executive functioning does. But the core thing here is some things matter and are advantage and other things are not. So I refer to this in this kind of metaphor of a flashlight. So if you're in a darkened room, this aspect of attention would be like having a flashlight privilege wherever it is that you're directing it toward. And the holding of the flashlight is its sort of endogenous or control capability that you can move around and guide what you need to do on a sort of piece by piece basis to put together, you know, making your way out of the room if you're in a darkened room. So the features of this kind of attention are really narrow, constrained, high signal to noise ratio. But if we move away from that system and kind of talk about the next aspect of attention, it's almost the exact opposite. And it might even tie into what you were describing as awareness, which is formally the brain's alerting system. So this we could think of as privileging not the content, like the flashlight, but the moment. Because really, when you think about being alert, it's about what is happening, the full spectrum of what is happening right now. You can't save up being alert for later. Low signal to noise ratio, broad, receptive, and sometimes I'll refer to this as sort of a floodlight. Just everything that is happening without a selectivity is illuminated in this moment for your full conscious access. So narrow, directed, broad, and receptive. And then the third aspect of attention, which of course, all of these interact with each other in some way and are supported by distinct brain systems. The third aspect is really regarding goal-related selection. So it's not based on the particular content or the moment, like the first two, but what are my goals in this moment? What do I want to be doing? And then ensuring that our actions align with our goals. So something called executive functioning, and this system's job, or you might call it attentional control, this system's job is to ensure that goals and actions are aligned and to course correct when they're not. And I like the metaphor here of a juggler. So you're kind of keeping all the balls in the air. You're not trying to do every single individual task, but you're overseeing and coordinating. So all three of these in my mind very much relate to mindfulness and mindfulness practice, which I'm happy to talk about next, but just want to pause. Is there anything else you wanted to ask me about?
So just to frame that just slightly differently, but you should give it an experiential sense for people. So people are obviously listening to us now and trying to pay attention to the thread of this conversation, but they might be doing other things simultaneously. They might be taking a walk or driving and paying attention to other things. And so they're this kind of spotlight function of awareness that can select a subset of experience, however momentarily, is constantly doing that, right? So they get distracted from the flow of this conversation by something in the environment they might suddenly notice that might, quote, demand their attention. And all of that competition is happening in the context of this wider field of awareness that you just described as a kind of floodlight. It's the space of the wider space of experience from which things can get promoted to focus, where you know the background can suddenly become foreground. Mm-hmm. So you can take this in one sensory channel, right? So if you're looking in your visual field, you can focus on a single object, you know, and you can attempt to focus on that thing to the exclusion of everything else, and yet you still notice that you see more than that object. There's stuff in your peripheral field that might suddenly capture your attention. You know, if someone suddenly just steps into the room, you're going to notice and turn your head and engage that person, right? So
By the way, I'm sorry, finish your thought.
Yeah. So there's this kind of foreground background dynamic we can see in what we notice in awareness, and it can be ever changing. And so you know that really grabs two of the concepts I mentioned at the outset, which is attention, this narrow focus, and awareness or consciousness, which admits of a much wider field of contents. And now we're bringing in mindfulness to the picture, which is this export from Buddhism explicitly, although it has analogs in other traditions, which is a way of training the mind to pay attention in a very specific way. Yeah. So Amishi, bring in mindfulness. How do you think about it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that just to go back to what you said a second ago, right, the broader field of the unfolding of what occurs in our experience, some of which we have conscious access to, and the spotlighting of information. So I would say in some sense, if the spotlighting can happen in all three ways that I described, the spotlight can literally be like a spotlight where you're highlighting some part of space and not other part of space, or it can be spotlighting in quotes of this moment relative to other things that are happening in your past or something about the future, which would be more like alerting, or the spotlighting can be relative to the goals I'm holding right now. And that can be both in terms of how we relate to the external environment, like we were talking about the flashlight being pointed toward a part of space, as well as the internal environment.
Yeah.
And part of the reason I really like that flashlight approach is it's like, and I will get to mindfulness in a second. I just did want to kind of mention this because it relates to the full scope of what mindfulness, I think, will help with. The flashlight metaphor is useful because we can hold a flashlight. We have that agency and control. But if we are walking down a darkened path, and we're pointing the flashlight toward where we want to walk it. It's goal-directed attention, right? So sort of executive control and this kind of capacity to select are working together. If you hear a rustling, what's going to happen? You're going to get captured by it. The flashlight, even without much preparation, is going to be pointing to something else, probably where you thought you heard the noise come from. So not only is it endogenous or controlled, but it can be exogenous and captured by things that are happening in our environment. And this flashlight can be pointed to internal mental content and can also be captured by internal mental content. So if I ask you to remember, you know, what you had for dinner last night, in some sense, what you're doing is recalling the episode of last night's events, pointing the flashlight to the granular time period of dinner, maybe even visualizing what you had and pulling that out so you have more access to that information. Or it could be captured by like a thought, like, oh, shoot, did I leave my, you know, faucet running or whatever it might be. So I think that the internal external domain, as well as this multiplicity of how we spotlight information, is important to think about. Now, the excitement for me regarding mindfulness is that it seemed to cover a lot of this terrain. And the way that I would describe mindfulness sort of most broadly is that it's a mental mode, a way of making the mind. It's an intrinsic capacity. You don't get mindful only by practicing mindfulness meditation. You hold this in what you possess in your mind. And that mental mode is characterized by this sort of purposeful attention to our present moment experience with these qualities of non-elaboration and non-reactivity. So we're doing our best when we are in a mindful mode of getting the raw data, not an editorialized version, but the raw data of our present moment experience that has both to do with what's happening sort of externally and internally.
Yeah. So again, just to take another pass over that same ground with slightly different words, what mindfulness is, as you say, it's not some artifice that you're adding to your experience. You're invoking a capacity of the mind that you already have. It is in fact attention. It is noticing what you notice in each moment, but it is doing it in a non-discursive and, one could argue, ultimately non-conceptual way, which is that you're, you know, insofar as it's possible to make contact with the raw data of experience in all your sensory channels and in your mind. It is attempting to do that, and it's also attempting to do it in a way that is not reactive to what is pleasant and unpleasant, because our habitual mode is to notice that much of our experience is valenced, and sometimes quite strongly valenced, positively or negatively. So things taste really good, or they taste really bad, they feel really good, or they feel really bad. We like the way certain, you know, ideas and thoughts feel, you know, their implications, and we have strong emotional reactions to them. And all of that reactivity is what mindfulness as a practice is designed to bypass and ultimately quiet, right? I mean, the goal of mindfulness is not merely to be mindful from the point of view of Buddhist practice. It's to achieve a kind of equanimity in the mind where the mind is no longer reacting to the pleasant and unpleasant in the usual ways. And where a kind of native tranquility and well-being can be found in the present moment, really, orthogonal to anything that's happening, right? So your happiness, if the practice succeeds, your sense of well-being and fulfillment and happiness is no longer contingent upon the changing winds of experience, right? It's not, your happiness is no longer predicated on, can I secure this next thing that I just thought to desire. Rather, you're noticing something about the native capacity of the mind to be open and relaxed. And you know, we can talk about this, but even positively valenced in a way that is not reaching forward into experience in a grasping, anticipatory, you know, greedy way, but is actually just positively valenced based on the fact that it's no longer contracting, it's no longer reacting, it's no longer at war with experience inside or outside, but it's just open. And so mindfulness as a practice is a way of invoking that kind of attention and training it to the point where it becomes a kind of default. You know, that takes some practice, but that's the goal of the practice.
Absolutely. And I love the way you put it regarding the sort of naturally emerging equanimity and positive leaning mind, right? So you're not contriving anything. Because again, when you're contriving, you're elaborating or you're conceptually constraining in some rigid way. And the thing that becomes interesting from the brain training perspective is, well, what do you do to get there? So if we all have this mode, why do we need to bother practicing mindfulness and mindfulness exercises and or mindfulness practices? And what are the factors that deter us from holding that mental mode more often? And this gets into what I would sometimes refer to as sort of the dark matter of cognition, which or also known as distractibility or mind wandering, having off-task thoughts during an ongoing task or activity. And so one of the ways that I like to describe mindfulness is using this sort of metaphor of an MP3 player and thinking about our capacity, our intrinsic capacity for mental time travel. There's a lot of chatter happening, and we're filled with that chatter. And oftentimes that chatter takes us to the past so that we can reflect on it, or it takes us to the future so we can plan for it. But oftentimes, especially for the kinds of populations that my lab works with, under high stress circumstances, especially when those periods are protracted, you're rewinding and fast forwarding in very unproductive ways. So that now when you're rewinding, the chatter may be a lot of rumination and you're kind of that flashlight is yanked to the past and almost stuck there. Or you are forecasting a doom-filled catastrophic scenario in the future, which you just made up in your mind. And in some sense, this is what we're kind of jockeying between, rumination and catastrophizing. And so when we think about what mindfulness is, it's keeping the button on play so that you are actually experiencing the moment-to-moment unfolding of what is transpiring of your life, frankly. And so this also, I think, makes it very kind of accessible. Like, okay, I get that. I get that there's a need for me to do something because I can imagine the tendency of my mind. And we know what the data says about 50% of our waking moments. We're not here. We're in the past or the future, you know, and kind of rapidly going back and forth between those. So it will take some kind of exercise if I want more moments where I spontaneously end up able to be in the mindful mode in the present moment with that button on play.
Yeah. Well, one thing I like about that metaphor is that it cuts through this association, which can even get ramified by adopting the practice of mindfulness, that mindfulness is this thing you're adding to your experience strategically so as to change it, right? So that, you know, before you learn how to practice mindfulness, you hear about it as a practice, and then you get some instruction. And in the beginning, that might be to focus on the breath. And, you know, gradually you begin to include everything in your experience, but you're still focusing strategically on experience, and it can seem like you're doing something. Whereas in reality, when the practice is actually working, what you're doing is less of something. You're less distracted, right? So you're on play more and more. And the truth is, there really is only play, right? I mean, your life is always on play, and what you're calling rewind and fast forward are really just the intrusions of thoughts about the past and the future.
Absolutely.
And you're not noticing thoughts as thoughts because you're distracted by them and identified with them. And mindfulness is just this ultimate stepping back into a recognition that you are simply this condition in which everything is appearing, thoughts about the past, thoughts about the future, present percepts and sensations. And there's simply this condition of appearance, and you can either recognize it clearly or you can be confused. You can be in a kind of waking dream where you are unaware of your actual condition, right? I mean, there is something, perhaps we can bring in this other feature here, which we have begun to talk about but not named, which is this, what is the nature of our distraction? I mean, there's this capacity we have to be thinking without clearly knowing that thoughts are arising. And what's more, we not only don't recognize the presence of thought clearly, we feel in some way identical to our thoughts. We feel that the arising of this next thought seems to be our true condition as subjects in the middle of our experience. It seems to create a middle of experience, right? We don't feel identical to the totality of our experience. We feel like we are having an experience and we're appropriating it from one side or from some position in the head as a subject. And this feeling of subjectivity, this feeling of self, the feeling that there's this I in the middle of things is what it feels like to be identified with thought. It's what it feels like to be thinking without clearly knowing the status of each arising thought as an appearance in consciousness.
Absolutely. And that's where we can talk about it as cognitive fusion. I mean, there's many words to describe what that is and sort of what the antidote to that might be in terms of defusion or decentering. But if I could just take a moment to talk about even the most basic or let's say foundational practice of mindfulness, because I mean, I see where you're going. And, you know, there's this sort of three-dimensional model that my colleagues Antoine Lutz and John Dunn and Cliff Sarin and I developed that tries to capture all three of these regarding this object orientation, like we've been talking about. There is something I'm focusing on.
I've met each of those guys, but I haven't seen them in quite some time. So nice to hear their names.
I mean, we can talk about sort of the multidimensionality. We call it the matrix of mindfulness. But if we just go back to sort of the foundational practice that, you know, everybody listening to us can anchor around. So if it's something like mindfulness of the breath, and the instruction, again, is focus on breath-related sensations, where you're saying as sensory as possible with regard to those. So in some sense, the flashlight is focused on an anchoring object, which is the unfolding of the breath without manipulating it in any way. And the second part of the instruction being notice when your mind has wandered away. So in some sense, the floodlight is on. What is happening in my unfolding experience right now? And then the third, which is redirect back, which is essentially, am I on my goal-related task? And for the formal period of time I'm doing this mindfulness of breath practice, my attention should be on breath-related sensations. So even if you shorthand this, and a lot of our military colleagues will call this our mental push-up. So focus, notice, redirect, and repeat as what might be going on in an unfolding of a couple 20-minute, 10-minute, 12-minute mindfulness practice. The qualities that you're talking about become engaged and exercised pretty quickly. And the idea is that the repeated engagement in those aspects are what get strengthened and allow us to then carry them around, like you said, by default. So being able to have a target for where you should be placing your mind in the backdrop allows you to see when you're off that target. And part of that requires kind of tuning in to what is the unfolding of my present moment experience. I'm watching it. And that watching requires a distancing between my immersion in the experience, you know, essentially making me the object of my experience instead of the subject of my experience, which is where we can start talking about decentering, where I'm taking a more distanced perspective. And that distancing also allows me to now maybe even see more clearly what's going on, that these thoughts, feelings, sensations, memories, all this stuff arising, they're simply mental phenomena that are coming into kind of full fruition in my conscious experience now and then potentially fading away. So it was this aspect that got me excited, like, oh my goodness, I see how each of the kind of fundamental systems of attention is getting engaged over and over again. And through their engagement, we're cultivating an even sort of more exciting capacity, which is to watch the mind at some distance to get clearer data on what is going on.
I want to talk about the brain basis of attention and mindfulness and distraction, insofar as we know it at this point. But do you think it matters which bases in experience one uses to train mindfulness? I mean, do you think that there's any difference between being mindful of the breath, say, or being mindful of sounds or sights, right? Like, because it's very, in the beginning, people pick these arbitrary objects and preferentially train attention on them. So for a very long time, you can be doing what's called, you know, mindfulness of the body, because the Buddha described four foundations of mindfulness. And it's often taught, or seemingly taught, it's implied at least, that any foundation is as good as any other foundation for achieving the results you want. And I've always wondered, I mean, in the limit, perhaps that's true, but I've always wondered if, you know, along the way, there are significant differences in spending that much time focused in precisely that way on a subset of experience, right? So if you're spending all your time focusing on the rising and falling of the abdomen, right, which is one way that people focus on the breath, as opposed to all your time listening to sounds in your environment. And in each of these techniques, you're doing it dispassionately, you're letting go of thoughts, you're just connecting with the raw data of experience, and you're not clinging to the pleasant or pushing the unpleasant away. But it does seem to me that neurologically, you're still doing something fairly distinct between those two types of training. And if you're spending 10,000 hours doing one versus the other, you might achieve a different result in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the answer is yes and no. So in some sense, if you think about the way that attention is a what we'd call domain general capacity exists, its very nature is supposed to be that you can use it for a variety of different content domains. And those could be different sensory domains like vision or, you know, auditory functioning or body sensations or even concepts. But what it's doing is going to be the same on it, which is amplifying certain aspects and essentially improving the efficiency which with that amplification can happen. So if you spend 10,000 hours focusing on a particular visual image, it's very likely, with the qualities that you described, a sort of kind of core mindfulness quality of this presence-centered, non-judgmental, non-reactive orientation or mode, then the visuals, if we do this with a visual image, it's very likely that not only will frontal lobe function improve, meaning the brain network involved in kind of control processes of attention, but its connection to visual cortex would be strengthened. Versus I'm going to do some kind of sound practice, probably it'd be to temporal or auditory cortex. Or if I'm doing some kind of repetition of a phrase, I'm going to have, you know, different language areas that could be the efficiency of that relationship would improve. But the core attentional functioning probably would be the same. And what it tends to look like is that that is the case, that when you compare different traditions and different functions, if the recipient of that mindful orientation differs, the system with which frontal lobe attention systems will connect will be different, but the frontal lobe, I don't want to call it frontal lobe, but the control circuitry will be the same. At least that's the picture that's emerging. And in some sense, if you want to maximize the flexibility and generalizability of the strengthening of attention, it might even be a good idea to vary what the recipient is, whether it is a sound or a body sensation or something else, because the target or anchor may not really be the thing that you care about most, but really cultivating the control of your relationship to it that you're looking at.
Yeah. And I've often worried that a narrow focus, I mean, let's say that you use interoception as your foundation, which is effectively what one is doing if one is focusing on the rising and falling of the abdomen, that gets pretty quickly to just a sense of the internal body states as one's primary focus. Mm-hmm. How much one wants to be, you know, growing one's connections to insular cortex,
right?
You know, is, you know, given all that that does. I mean, the insula is, it's doing many essential things, but it's also the basis for feelings of disgust and sensitivity to a wide variety of internal states. Which, if you turn up the volume on all of that, I can imagine, and you know, having done a fair amount of practice of that sort, I wasn't thinking about it in neuroanatomical terms at the time, but I can imagine that it can make you sensitive to things that where increasing sensitivity in that channel isn't actually making you more functional, much less wise, right? Like to be acutely conscious of your, the state of your gut does not equip you to function happily in most experiences most of the time, right? And it can actually become synonymous with just something like, you know, irritable bowel syndrome, right? Like it's not what you want to be have capturing your attention all the time.
Right.
And, you know, so insofar as the practice is not, the goal of the practice is not to become more inward and neurotic and distracted by one's, you know, every, digestive misadventure, it's worth taking a moment to think about the consequences of paying attention to specific things. I agree that it does make sense to just cast the net of attention as widely as possible and remain aware that the goal is upstream of any one of the downstream channels that we might notice, right? It's at the seat of, are you actually able to remain awake and aware and equanimous given all the things you notice moment to moment?
Absolutely. So I would say for sure, we want to think through the downstream systems that we're going to be interacting with, so to speak. And for sure, we do adjust when there are particular populations where it's a particularly bad idea, right? Somebody that has high anxiety or hypervigilance, you don't want them to spend a lot of time in sensations that are already going to be at baseline heightened. And so you might do something like, don't close the eyes and focus on sort of the interoceptive landscape. Instead, let's keep your eyes open and maybe do something that has to do with an active practice, like the sensations of the feel of the ground as you're walking.
Yeah.
So I think things have to be adjusted in a way that we can do it ourselves, obviously, but also as we're thinking about what to offer people from a variety of different backgrounds and predispositions and even illnesses, we want to be sensitive to that. So that's true on the one hand, and I agree with you. I think I agree with myself because I said it initially, but that we want to probably mix it up and be sensitive to where it is that we're putting our focus in terms of the anchor. The other side of it is, though, that in doing this in a multiple kind of way, by not rejecting any particular channel as the anchoring content domain on which we're going to place this particular mindful orientation, does give us a chance to develop more familiarity with a particular set of phenomena. So though it may be correct or true that focusing on the gut isn't going to do all that much for you in this sort of broad sense, it may actually familiarize you as you start understanding that, oh, that particular sensation in the body is tied to this type of emotion that arises. And those kind of couplings can allow us to have more familiarity with what is going on moment by moment. And is part of the insight, I think, that we can develop an advantage for ourselves, because now when we have that little ache in the side of our you know, left side, oh, I might be really feeling tense. I notice in my practice that tends to happen, or whatever the particular things are. But so I'd say, again, kind of yes and no, that I think that we should be broad, yet we should think about benefiting intimacy or familiarity with various aspects of our experience.
So what are the neural correlates of the seat of attention, as you've been describing it, and what does mindfulness do to, characteristically do to brain function? And I think inevitably something about the default mode network will find its way in here. What do we know about the antithesis of mindfulness at the level of the brain? I mean, what is distraction? What is mind wandering? What is, I guess, there are other types of reactivity to experience that we might talk about, but yeah, what does the goal look like, and what are our failure modes?
Right. And you know, this is a very nicely emerging literature. I mean, this is so heartwarming to me as somebody who started her career in mindfulness pretty lonely. I mean, I could talk to Richie, but that was about it at that point. And most of my colleagues thought I was absolutely nuts to decide to study mindfulness in those days. So it is really nice to see how much we have learned, and not just with regard to mindfulness, but in general, in terms of brain function over the last 20 years. So when I was going to grad school, of course, we thought of the brain as modular, and we talked about regions, like I was starting to kind of default to, like the frontal lobe does this and the parietal lobe does this. And of course, now we don't see brain function in that modular way. We see it in a network way, so that there is an entire series of nodes that coordinate and collaborate to produce certain kinds of mental processes. And that network view has really helped, I think, strengthen our understanding. And there's sort of two ways to think about it. One is from the point of view of what happens when you're actually practicing. So you're doing a mindfulness practice, what networks are active at what points in time? And then kind of extrapolating that, if you practice for a long time, what might become intrinsically sustained changes in the operating of these brain networks? And then, of course, you can go even one step beyond that and say, how might that network functioning result in sustainable structural changes in the brain? And that's sort of, I think, the journey of brain training and neuroplasticity. So in terms of describing what happens and what brain networks are involved, I think it might help to start talking about what happens during a practice itself and how we can name these networks. And of course, this is an extremely simplified view, right? We know that the complexity of the brain is enormous and these dynamics are really, it's a delicate dance. But in general, what we could say is that when we have the instruction to focus our attention on a specific object, there's kind of two prominent things that might happen. The first is that we have our, what we call the central executive network or frontal parietal control network, an attentional network that involves parts of the frontal lobes and the parietal cortex that function together as, you know, in a coordinated manner, are going to be more active to sustain the goal. Like my goal right now is to hold this in mind. And then I'm going to deploy my attention. That might be something called the dorsal attention network, or depending on what part of the brain what sensation we're anchoring on, could be a different kind of network. But The point is, there's one thing overseeing it, which is really this juggler idea. Hmm. And then there's the workhorse system that's keeping the control, like pointing the flashlight. So those two are doing the controlling. Then what happens if you're doing a practice is you're sitting there, okay, focusing on the breath. What am I going to have for lunch tomorrow? You know, oh my goodness, I can't believe I have to be in the scanner doing this thing, or X, Y, and Z. Multiple thoughts arise, whether you're doing a brain imaging study or not. But, and then, you know, so actually let's capture that moment. What happens when I have now gone internal, self-referential, and essentially completely not focused on the goal that I've been holding in mind? That's where we would say the prominent activity will be in a different network. As you mentioned, the default mode network, which is a part of its nodes are involved in functioning for self-related processing. And it's its own kind of world of whether that's self-related and memory-related, whether that's mentalizing. There's a whole bunch of stuff, fun stuff that happens in the default mode. But the point is, you're not focused on external goal-directed task functioning. You have really gone internal. So where we started out with the prominence of control networks that are tied to the frontal lobes functioning, we now have gone to the default mode, which is more medial structures in the brain. I mean, I don't really care if people know the specific neuroanatomy, but the point is it's a very different network. Now, all of a sudden, we have an aha moment of, oh my goodness, I'm sitting here, I'm supposed to be focusing on the breath, and I'm not. What we see happening in those kind of aha moments of getting ourselves back on track, noticing mind wandering had occurred, and now I've got to re-engage, is the salience network, which is another network that you already mentioned, one of its key structures, the insula, and another part would be the anterior cingulate cortex. This is sort of the detector of what's going on right now. And it's also considered the switch that moves our attention from internal, aka default mode is active, to external, or frontal lobe structures are now frontal lobe control functions are networks are activated. So it's sort of like, you know, frontal lobe activity, frontal control structures activity, default mode activity, salience network activity. And now I have to get back on task. Let me redirect my attention back to that frontal parietal control network. So we see this as sort of a circular, cyclical process of different networks kind of holding hands with each other and reacting to each other to give us a picture of what is prominent moment by moment as we're practicing. And just to say that what we see emerging now is the profile of what happens with people that have done a multi-week mindfulness training is that activity within those networks seems to be changing, as well as the connections between networks seems to be becoming more efficient, all in support of dialing down mind wandering or self-referential processing, increasing detection of what is happening moment by moment, as well as better control of holding our goals and having our actions align with those goals. That's your brain science 101 for mindfulness.
Yeah, that's great. One interesting thing that has fallen out of the research on the default mode is it's called the default mode because it is this was discovered in a variety of neuroimaging experiments. It is this network of regions that are, you know, in the midline of the brain, which increase their activity between tasks. I mean, that's what was called the brain's default mode, is what the brain seemed to return to when it's waiting for the next stimulus, and it was really independent of whatever was being studied.
And it's it is a funny story, right? And I still remember those days. I don't know if you were in graduate school at that point, but of like, we didn't know what the heck was going on. Like you basically do these experiments in which you do something that is very attentionally demanding, and that for, let's say, 6 minutes, just do a task, 6 minutes, you're in the scanner, and you see this nice frontal lobe related network activated, attentional control network. Then you say, okay, rest for a few minutes. And that was just supposed to be the comparison. And instead of the brain going kind of generally quiet, what you found was that there was a whole other network that was more active during rest. And so it became known as like the task negative, meaning you're not engaged in a task negative network. But also, because it was so prominent during rest, people started kind of thinking about it as, you know, the rest network in some sense of like what you do when you don't have to do anything else. And it's really funny, the acronym for REST, which I think gives us a clue when we ask people, well, what are you doing when I ask you to rest? REST, rapid, ever-present, self-related thinking. Mm. And that kind of ends up being true. I mean, we just kind of joked about it in the early days, but if you look at a more granular level of the sub-regions, of the sub-nodes that comprise the default mode network, they have a lot to do with self-referential processing, episodic memory, et cetera. So yeah, it is by default in some sense, but it's not just default in general. It's when it's self-related defaulting. Yeah. And I guess we just do that a lot.
Yeah. So that was the other part of this literature that they found the same regions were active or were preferentially more active when you gave people stimuli that related to self-related processing, right?
So exactly.
Does this word apply to you or not?
Right, right. Yeah. And that's very cool. And that's why it's sort of exciting to see. Now we have a sense of what the major players might be. We have a emerging picture that says, not only do we see in multiple experiments that, people are mind wandering less if they go through a multi-week mindfulness training program, and that aspects of the way this default, how sort of extremely activated it is dialed down with more and more mindfulness practice.
Well, and it also gives some neuroanatomical justification for the claim that insofar as you become more mindful, that is, insofar as you dial down the activity of this midline network, it would make sense for your sense of self to change and become more attenuated and ultimately, as it's claimed in the literature, to seem no longer present, right? Or certainly no longer present in the usual way. And I'm wondering what you think about that. I mean, how do you think about the sense of self? I referred to it earlier in this conversation by different terms of, talking about the sense that there's a center to experience as opposed to there just being experience. How do you think about the ancient goal that is not, I guess it's in certain secular quarters, there's some lip service paid to it, but in general, mindfulness has been removed from its traditional context within Buddhism and given a set of more humble and seemingly practical goals, right? I mean, rather than to become an enlightened Buddha, people are adopting it in the main to just be less stressed out, to be able to pay better attention, to feel less anxiety, et cetera. But, the ultimate goal is to wake up from the dream of egocentricity that is anchoring so much of our psychological suffering, if not all of our psychological suffering. I mean, it remains to be seen where the boundary is there, if there is one. How do you think about the more highfalutin goals of meditation and, certainly the most experienced yogis and lamas and meditators who have been studied in Richie Davidson's lab, and perhaps your own, are people who are really not in the game for, in the Jon Kabat-Zinn way of, mindfulness-based stress reduction. They've done their 10,000 hours or their 30,000 hours with a different, or a wider or deeper purpose in mind.
Well, it's interesting because this is almost exactly the kind of conversations that Cliff and John and Antoine and I had for 4 years as we were writing this paper. And it is funny because while, some of those folks, actually all three of them, have spent a lot more time with the more intensive, adept practitioners, I'm on the other side of the spectrum, frankly. I mean, the way I can talk to you about brain networks and I'm certainly very interested in the fundamental nature of what is happening and changing, my core interest is in improving access, implementation access to these tools to as many people as can be reached.
Yeah.
And I don't actually see the goals as highfalutin versus everyday. I see them as the same.
Mm-hmm.
Because if what you're saying is that in some sense, as you get closer and closer to understanding the actual nature of not the ordinary subjective experience that you have, but the actual nature of what is happening that gives you that your building blocks for experience, you have more agency to do something differently that might actually advantage your life and your functioning. So I connect the dots often. But to go back to your question regarding the, in some sense, I think you're talking about non-dual practice now, but going from the notion of a subject-object distinction, right? So let's I'm going to throw some terms out and you can clarify as you have been if you don't mind. So if one aspect of what emerges as we practice mindfulness is a better ability to become de-identified or disidentified with our experience so that we're watching what is unfolding. That is oftentimes referred to as decentering, right? We're a fly on the wall or we're hovering above, we're watching what's occurring, not from the direct eyes of I, but we're turning the subject into object. And I think that that's a very useful thing to do. You know, if I'm so immersed in the anxiety or fear I have, I can't even step back enough to see, oh my goodness, that's a contrivance in my own mind. It's just a mental event that's occurred and soon it'll be passing. So I think a subject-object distinction is very good. As you think about what that actually is, what does it mean to have an object in the mind, right? You've taken some mental event and you've turned it into a thing. Literally, you're calling it an object. So we've reified mental phenomenon into things. And it's that solidity with which we hold these mental phenomenon that can actually really tie us down and constrain us. Whether it's something like, I'm this kind of a person, or I always experience X, Y, or Z, or life has, you know, handed me this kind of set of factors, we're constrained by that. It's like a straitjacket. So one approach is, okay, at least watch the mind. The other approach, which we could call maybe more advanced, or we could call it as a different approach, which I think takes more practice, is challenge the notion of objectness. Actually see that that holding together of mental events is illusory. I mean, you made it up. I mean, and there's something that actually drives in the brain that happening, but that actually its nature is intrinsically not solid. And so that can happen with respect to the notion of self. You know, self itself is not solid, or any mental object we hold in mind. We have that kind of more fundamental understanding. And so this, I think, is a really cool way of thinking about how it's kind of multiple tools to get a better handle on what is actually happening moment by moment. And you know, I want to give you a chance to respond, but I do want to tell you something about perception and attention and how I think it actually relates to this. But go ahead. You were going to say something.
Yeah. So I think I would describe the experience a little differently. I mean, so, you know, in my view, there are two basic stages to mindfulness practice. I mean, one is dualistic and one is non-dual. Mm-hmm. And dualistic practice, I guess, fits the description of what you called decentering in the sense that you're...
Or a subject-object distinction.
Yeah. I mean, let's just make this real by talking about specifics. So just imagine someone is feeling very anxious about something they're thinking about. You know, they just receive some scary news about a medical diagnosis, or they're worried about a friend, you know, based on something they heard. So the mechanics here is that, you know, they were sitting, minding their own business, and then got some new piece of information. They got someone told them something, right? Someone made some mouth noises, and those got decoded as information. And now all of a sudden, this person is thinking about the future, thinking about their own health or the health of someone close to them. So they're now thinking. They're not aware they're thinking. I mean, they might, if you ask them, are you thinking right now? They'd say, oh, yeah, of course I'm thinking. They might be able to respond appropriately. But for each moment of thinking, they're not noticing thoughts as spontaneous appearances in a wider field of consciousness.
Right.
They're just busy thinking and feeling fully captured by the thought, and they have no perspective on it. And the emotional implications of the thought, you know, in this case, anxiety, are being fully kindled because of that identification and that lack of perspective, right? And they're not noticing the mechanics here. They're not noticing how thought is linking to and conjuring this feeling of anxiety, you know, the pins and needles of changing physiology in their face and in their chest and gut. And they're not noticing how the anxiety itself is prolonging their train of thought and invoking other thoughts of a similar character. And now they're remembering other friends who have cancer and, you know, how long they lived, and they've heard terrible things about chemotherapy, and should I do a Google search, or is that just going to be a nightmare, or who can I call? Like, so they're not seeing how that there's this perfect feedback, this, you know, positive feedback, which is quite negatively valenced between thought and emotion, and all of that begins to spin and spin and spin, and that can go on for hours and days and weeks, and, you know, it will be interrupted by other states of consciousness that they won't notice necessarily, and they'll feel like they are just living in this state of anxious misery, you know, for a very long time. And now mindfulness is recommended as a practice that can help one interrupt all that, right? It's not necessarily promising that you'll never feel anxiety again, but it'll give you something to do when anxiety arises. And what you can do is notice anxiety as this change in physiology. Just notice the raw data of, you know, sensation in the body. And in that act of noticing, once again, you notice any resistance you have to feeling it, and then you relax that, and you just feel it fully by being mindful of it. You're not running away from it. You're actually moving toward it, but toward it in a very sympathetic, open, and uncontracted mode. And that itself provides its own relief, because so much of the suffering of being anxious is not merely in the raw sensation of anxiety. It's in the contraction around it, the resistance to it, the desperation to no longer feel it, right? And so much of one's thoughts that are getting born out of that state and further ramified are purposed toward finding some strategy whereby one can be restored to a state that is no longer anxious, right? You want to get back to feeling the way you were before someone told you you might have cancer, right? And so now you're trying to get some good news to oppose to your bad news. And you want to find somebody who will say, oh no, well, have you heard about this treatment? Right. And so none of what I'm saying now suggests that you shouldn't actually treat cancer or see an oncologist or do any of the things you need to do to deal with that kind of health emergency. The point is, you have a choice. Once you know how to practice mindfulness, you have a choice you can make, this degree of freedom you just referred to, which is, how long do you want to suffer under the burden of that, of pure identification with unpleasant thought, when the truth is there's even in the context of a real medical emergency, 99% of your thinking about it is going to be pointless. Right. You once you decide what you have to do, it's like once you get the name of the oncologist who you have to see on Tuesday, well, then you're going to go see the oncologist on Tuesday. Now the question is, how many hours do you want to spend in the dreamscape of, living nightmare, thinking about what might happen to you in the future between now and Tuesday? And if the answer is not much at all, well, then mindfulness is the practice that would allow you to get off that ride every time it starts by simply noticing thoughts as thoughts and anxiety as energy in the body, and then coming back to what is in fact your actual experience more widely in that moment. Just the feelings of your feet on the ground, the sight of your child across the room, the vision of the sun setting on the horizon. I mean, you have a wider experience and your life in the present, and you can hit play again. And yet there's a dualistic version of that, which in the beginning can be incredibly useful, wherein, as you describe it, it's your stepping back and getting this wider perspective and noticing thoughts as thoughts and emotions as emotions, very much as objects from a point of view kind of outside of them. Again, not running away from them. I mean, you're still feeling the feelings as closely as you can, but it's quite clear that there's just changing objects of sensation in this wider field. But it's possible to do all of that while still feeling like you're doing it. You're the meditator. Mm-hmm. You're the one who's aiming the beam of attention at thoughts and at sensation, at emotion, and noticing that everything changes and nothing lasts, etc. The practice reaches its next stage, in my view, when you can notice that there's no one doing that, right? There is no meditator. There is no subject in the middle of experience aiming attention. There's no place from which to aim attention. There's simply everything arising as it does and being known as it is in this condition of consciousness. And you're not on the edge of it. You're not in the middle of it. You're identical to it. There simply is experience. And the sense that there's a self in the middle of experience is just more experience. And when you recognize that apparent boundary between self and world, or self and the internal states of the body, or self and ideas, that evaporates, and there's just this theater of appearances and changes, subjectively speaking. I'm not making any metaphysical claims about, cosmology or the relationship between consciousness and the brain or anything else. I'm just saying, as a matter of experience, you can lose this sense that you're on the edge of experience, looking in or looking over your own shoulder or even paying attention, and there can just be this unity of, rather than one who is hearing the thing that is heard, there's just this pure hearing or pure seeing in each moment. And You know, that might last only for a moment, you know, initially for people when they first recognize this. But once one can recognize this, then that is what is practiced. So you become mindful of that, not necessarily mindful of any specific channel of objects, like the breath or sensations in the body or sounds. You're just mindful of the fact that there's no center to experience in each moment.
Absolutely. That's wonderfully put. Yes. And that's what I was trying to get at, in the notion of objects themselves, is you realize the illusory nature of that.
Yeah.
And whether the object is the self from which you're taking this perspective of looking in, like you put it. And this is going back to that model I was telling you about. It's, you know, we wanted to describe what the full trajectory of that is, beginning with this notion of decentering, where you're going to accept that there will be an object-subject distinction, but you're essentially turning it from a subjective experience to subject as object. But really, it's on the path to understanding the illusory nature of objects themselves. So we actually refer to it as de-reification.
Mm.
And the de-reification is part of the path of understanding that self is not the same thing that you were just saying, a set of processes that are unfolding. But what I wanted to tell you that I think is so interesting. So when in 2009, I was invited to India and I was invited to give a talk to His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And one of the other speakers was like a eminent attention researcher who I had, and you probably know who she is when I say her name, but somebody that I had just been like so enamored by her work as a graduate student. So it's really cool to have an opportunity to be on a speaking panel with her. And she was
Do you
the
want
same
to say
age
her
as
name
the Dalai
or
Lama
you,
at that point. Yeah, I'll tell you her name. Anne Treisman. Anne Treisman, who it's so funny because, you know, who was the spouse of Danny Kahneman.
Yeah.
So every time my children talk about Danny Kahneman, I'm like, oh yeah, he's the husband of Anne Treisman. Anyway, so Anne Treisman was really understanding, one of the things that she is known for is understanding the role of attention in our perception of objects. And that one of the things that we know we need to perceive all of the different features that comprise an object into one, something referred to as binding, is attention. And when you do these experiments where you distract people or you don't give them the capacity or opportunity to pay attention, and you show them kind of simple images like a blue mug or a red jet on a screen, they will mix it up and say there was a jet, you know, and it was, and there was blue, but they might say it was a blue jet. So called illusory conjunctions. So you're mixing up the elements. That gives such an interesting insight into the way in which information might be registering in the first place, essentially as elements, and that our subjective or phenomenological experience is because of attention binding them together. And so I think it's a very natural aspect of the way the brain functions that we need this. We need this to operate in the world, et cetera. So, but when I think about this sort of path toward de-reification, in some sense, it is acknowledging, you know, being able to shine the lens of even attention itself as a process, so that you're kind of diffusing binding, so that you're getting the more direct experience of the elemental nature of what is unfolding. And I just think it was neat that she, all of her findings that, you know, all those years ago on perception, now I think we can relate more broadly to even concepts, conception, right? And even the notion of self as a concept. So there's a part of me that is very interested in seeing what happens as we unfold, as that path is developed. And also I wanted to ask you, because you said, you know, this is sort of the, I don't know how you put it, but essentially like you're more advanced if you can do this kind of a practice. How do you think it adds to one's ability to function when you have that capacity? Because we already talked about mindfulness as having utility, because you're not sitting there an anxious mess. What gets added when you can access non-dual modes?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, to talk about it from the other side for a second. So one thing that can persist when you're practicing mindfulness dualistically is what, you know, insofar as you're persuaded that there really is a deep goal to be achieved here, right? Like, you know, you take up the practice and you want not just, you know, some mitigation of your stress or some ability to pay better attention. You actually want to be, you know, fully awake and free of you know, all that ails you psychologically, right? You're convinced on some level you know, whether you're a Buddhist or not, or a fan of any, you know, Eastern tradition, you're convinced that this, the path may run, you know, all the way up the mountain, and you want to get to the summit, right? And so, you know, this, obviously this analogy of, you know, climbing a mountain is a traditional one that is often used to describe, you know, what any spiritual path is like. But explicit in that framing is this sense that you really are pretty far away from your goal. Even if you're trying to adopt the attitude of non-seeking and just, you know, being perfectly at home in the present, if you have this sense that you really are unenlightened and you're really, there really is some place to get to, and you've got a lot of work to do on yourself because, you know, just for the last moment you were noticing all the evidence of your bondage, and now you're coming back to the breath, and you've, in a goal-oriented way, you're trying to link one moment of mindfulness to the next, and you've dropped out of your life in the world to do this, and now you're on retreat, and you're going to spend the next 3 months in silence, meditating 12 to 18 hours a day, because you really, this makes sense to you. You have to break this spell of identification with self, and you have to get somewhere, you know, dualistically. It's possible under that framing, I would say it's more or less inevitable under that framing, to feel a tremendous amount of psychological stress that is unnecessary in the end, right? Like you can really get tied in knots, you know, contemplatively, feeling like you're basically becoming a Navy SEAL of meditation, right? Like this is just, there's a serious training, there's serious effort required. And you can find within Buddhism and in other traditions the type of teachings that kind of justify that view, right? And mm-hmm. So like one of my most impressive traditional Buddhist teachers was Upandita Sayadaw, and he was very much of this school. And, you know, the metaphor he seemed to like most, to give on retreat is that practicing mindfulness is like rubbing two sticks together to get fire. The moment you stop, they cool off and you're basically back to zero, right? So there's this sense that like every break in the continuity of your mindfulness really does come at the cost of demonstrating and more or less ensuring that you are far from your goal, right? Now, what changes with non-dual practice is that you recognize that consciousness is already without the structure of the ego. Mm-hmm. The ego is just what it's like not to notice that, what it's like to be identified with thought in each moment, or this undercurrent of thought. And when you break that spell, when you look and see that there is no center and there's just this open condition in which everything's appearing, well then, say, you know, to now use, you know, Dzogchen terminology, I mean, Dzogchen is this non-dual teaching within Tibetan Buddhism, you're then taking the goal as the path, right? In each moment of practice, real mindfulness, you're simply just enjoying the thing that you would otherwise seek as the goal of practice. And so, again, you can sort of fake this attitude in the beginning, and, you know, I certainly did that. I mean, you read certain styles of teaching mindfulness. I mean, Ajahn Chah, the great Thai master, tended to present the teachings in this way, or you can read Zen, you read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Suzuki. Those teachings impart a kind of non-seeking and non-dualism in the sense that they're not pushing you from behind with the sense that there really is a problem that you have to solve and only heroic effort is going to solve it. But adopting the attitude of non-seeking and non-duality isn't the same thing as actually being able to drop your problem and drop your sense of self in this next moment as easily as you would be able to just come back to the breath, right? I mean, the question is, what can you realize? Like, when a dualistic and non-dualistic practitioner are both lost in thought, well, then they're both lost in thought. But the difference is when they're no longer lost, when someone, you know, snaps their fingers and says, you know, come back, what can you realize now? The dualistic practitioner of mindfulness returns to the problem in some sense, the problem of having to pay attention for a reason. Now, granted, it can be very equanimous, it can be very pleasant, it can taste like a certain kind of freedom, and that's great, and that really is true. But if you were to ask a dualistic practitioner of mindfulness, Like, how in this moment do you know that you're not a Buddha already, right? How do you know you're unenlightened? He or she can usually tell you, right? I mean, you can find the thing that proves to you that you're still just this kind of ego-bound meditator still trying to work it out and untie the knot of self. Whereas once you can actually practice non-dualistically, to be asked that question is to be confronted by the pure mystery of being in that moment, which is not structured in the way that gives any evidence of a problem. And that's true even if the physiology of some negative state is still present. So I mean, let's say you were angry a moment ago, and then all of a sudden you become mindful. When you're doing that dualistically, you can break the spell of thinking about all the reasons why you should be angry, and you just feel the physiology, and you notice how that's beginning to dissipate, and you can taste the relief of that. You've stopped the wheel works of neurotic self-concern and reactivity for a moment, and they're no longer spinning, and now just the energy is dissipating, and you do have a degree of freedom, and there is choice in that, and it's a good one, and it's all like you can decide not to say the thing that what was just occurring to you to say that's going to screw up your relationships, etc. So all of that's wonderful. But if you're practicing non-dualistically, the moment you notice that there's no center to what you were calling anger a moment ago, anger is no longer anger, right? There's just energy, right? And your freedom in that moment isn't contingent even upon the energy changing, right? Like the energy of anger could still mm-hmm. be there. This is how, you might know something about the tantric teachings within Buddhism. And this is, within Tantra, which I've never really practiced explicitly, but the philosophy of Tantra is that you can use the energy states of even negative emotion as the fuel for recognizing emptiness and freeing the mind. And from the non-dual side, the way that makes sense is that, yes, you can recognize in the moment of recognizing anger non-dualistically, it is just as bright an appearance that articulates the open space of emptiness, of non-dual consciousness, just as much as any other appearance, right? And it's because of its energetics, it can actually, wake you up more than some other, less energetic experience. And so you can use it as fuel for freeing your mind of attachment and self-clinging, even as it's present, right? So your freedom is not at all predicated on getting rid of that energy in the next moment, even though it will dissipate because you're no longer thinking about the thing that made you angry. So the logic of suddenly becoming mindful has changed, which is to say there need not even be any logic ultimately, because you're just recognizing the more basic condition, which is already free and inherently free of the sense of self, rather than trying to do something as a practice in the next moment. And so that was a very long-winded response to your question, but it is a consequential difference, because you really can drop your problem. You really, even in the presence of pain, in the presence of significant suffering that was all too real a moment ago, you can get real relief that, again, is not predicated on impermanence. It's not predicated on, okay, now this is going to slowly disappear. It's predicated on the recognition that, on some level, that which is aware of sadness isn't sad, mm-hmm. I mean, and it's the same as that which is aware of joy. And there's just, it's like the, another analogy that I often use, which captures it for me. It's like if you've ever gone into a room, like let's say a restaurant that has a floor-to-ceiling mirror along one wall, and not have noticed it as a mirror, and you spend, let's say, the better part of a meal thinking that the room is twice the size that it actually is, right? There's like all those people over there, but then you suddenly recognize that it's a mirror, right? And those people don't even exist. Those, the people on the left are just a reflection of the people on the right. That change, right, that fundamental shift from the real to the unreal, or from reification to emptiness, that gets accomplished in non-dual practice. That gets accomplished in a very, there's nothing piecemeal about that transition. And rather than be mindful strategically of all the beauty and ugliness you see over there and try not to react to it, and then be mindful of your reaction when you react, et cetera, et cetera. It's analogous to somebody just like putting their hand on the glass and recognizing the status of everything in there as totally superficial. And it's just all light. There are no mm-hmm. boundaries between the beauty and the ugliness. There's just, you know, this expanse of, you know, luminosity, that transition from just total confusion to total clarity by just putting your hand on the glass, that is this kind of step change that one experiences going from dualistic practice to non-dual practice in one's mindfulness. So that's, anyway, yeah, there are definitely benefits, but it's hard to, even if there weren't benefits, it would still seem more real than not noticing this, right? Like, if, like you're not noticing it because there are benefits.
No, of course.
Yeah, once you notice it, you can't not notice it.
Right. The other way to put it, and it's the benefits thing is just a very practical question.
Yeah,
I think it's, you know, that's, I guess it tells you where my head is. But the other part is, I guess a better way to ask the question is, what processes are either engaged or disengaged to allow you to see the clear aspects of what's going on? You know, again, I'm going to just give my analogy of the binding problem. So in some sense, if you think about any concept as sort of the elements of the hanging together of all the elements, I mean, of all the components in that concept, it's like you can have all those. It's just, if you kind of think of a simple model of like every component is like a dot on a screen. And when it's held together, all those dots are highly interconnected and it looks solid, like a structure that's solid. And in some sense, what is happening as you're approaching the non-dual perspective is you're seeing that they are actually, every component is just there simultaneously. There's nothing solid there. So in some sense, maybe even the connections between those things are, I don't know, made up, but co-arising in a way that gives you the phenomenological experience of its thingness. And I mean, I just think that this is a really interesting space to pursue. Like, actually, what is it that's different? Because I hear you in the words that you're saying, but sort of functionally, what's different? And it does still remind me of Anne Treisman and the binding problem. There's something about your way of experiencing it that, as you describe it, is closer to the truth of what's happening, but there is a different way that you are experiencing it. So how do we characterize that? That's one thing to say. The second thing I want to say is just, oh, go ahead.
Well, actually, I had a quick response to, I don't know if this is on point, but so Dzogchen practice is traditionally taught eyes open. And well, I've never heard a justification of this from the Dzogchen side. It's always struck me that one advantage of practicing with eyes open is that the loss of the sense of subject-object dualism is much more salient, because so much of our reification of dualism is with reference to the visual field, right? I mean, we define ourselves visually as separate from our environment more than we do it auditorily or, you know, in any other sensory channel. So it's not to say you can't recognize non-duality with your eyes closed. You certainly can, but it's harder, certainly in the beginning. And it's especially salient in a social context when you're, you know, face to face with another person, right? When you're when you're looking at another person's face and they're looking back at you, the difference between feeling the collapse into self and experiencing the recognition of non-duality is very, very salient, because, you know, it tends to have so much emotional and kind of mimetic topspin when you're, you know, looking into somebody's eyes and talking to them and processing their reaction to you. When you're doing all of that from the position of not feeling like an I, right, not feeling the cramp of self, the connection to psychological freedom is very direct, right? I mean, you're quite literally not worrying what they think of you in that moment, and all of your attention is free to just pay attention to them, right? So it transforms social space in a very direct way. But what I was going to say is, I don't know why I remembered this, but and it's been a while since I played with this, but when meditating with eyes open, I think if you look at a bistable percept like a Necker cube, I don't know if this would be true of many of them, but I think a Necker cube pop out is probably a reporter of dualistic fixation. I think if you're just resting in non-dual awareness, there's no pop out.
Right. You're not getting that shifting view.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the pop-out, you called it. Yeah,
you're just seeing the two-dimensional. Mm-hmm.
That's probably where my thought came from regarding this like kind of structure. the dots with the lines probably was a Necker cube idea. But yeah, I mean, I think that is the kind of thing that people are looking at now with Sobchak practice, is sort of even the bistability and the lack of bistability that can happen, and the EEG signatures that might not be present when you go from prominence of one perspective versus the other perspective. Mm. So I do think we're going to be able to get some kind of handle on that as we start yoking phenomenology with the kind of a microstate or very fast depiction of what's going on in the brain.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would be interesting to do an fMRI experiment where you had people who can practice in this way simply press the button every time the Necker cube popped out, you know, one way or the other.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that I wouldn't do it with fMRI, given the sluggish nature of blood flow. I think doing it with EEG would be the right approach. And now that we have microstates, which are 60 to 120 milliseconds, we can actually probably capture it better in time. But I like the idea a lot. So when you come into the lab.
Yeah, it would be interesting. I mean, it would be interesting to do. I think as far as the time course issue with the bold response, I think, well, one, you provided you had people who were familiar with the practice, you would get longer period. I mean, the pop-out periods would be punctate, but the periods between pop-out would be longer. I mean, certainly on the order of.
Oh, I think you could do it.
Seconds.
I'm just saying, let's do both, or at least check out the EEG signature, just because it's going to be more tightly.
Yeah.
You know, the chronology will be better captured.
Do you ever work with simultaneous MRI and EEG?
No, I have not. I mean, we've tried it. It's a real technical pain.
It's a hassle,
to try to get clean signal, but you know, we've certainly done each separately. But I wanted to actually kind of go back to this whole conversation we just had, which is to me just like the most fun. And I learned a lot, just because as somebody who has not done Sobchak practice, thank you. It's almost like a transmission, Sam. But the other thing I wanted to tell you, just kind of from where—
Hopefully I'm not also transmitting the cold I have over here, which I'm trying to keep under wraps.
But what I was going to say is, remember when we started this conversation and you asked me sort of what led me to studying this stuff and where I'm coming from in terms of my interest. And it was a very practical set of questions. So I described that I was interested in figuring out how to protect attention from the vulnerabilities that can derail it and make it fail. And I was telling you that this was in the early 2000s. Well, the other thing that was happening in the early 2000s is that we had it was just after 9/11. And so we were in a context where, as I was saying at the outset, there are many people that were going to be in very difficult, high stress, high demand circumstances for whom attention and having it was not some nice to have, but was life or death for them or other people. And so oftentimes when I ask the question of like, how is that more beneficial, or how do we get there with more efficiency? It is with that implementation EYE, because I do want to understand how to give folks access to, you know, tools that will advantage attention's functioning. So I definitely have a more practical goal of doing that. And I don't know what the relationships are. I mean, I'm starting to kind of get very curious about the relationships between non-dual practices and attention. And I can see how it might allow more capacity to return to you because of all that's not lost from the sort of contingent goal-directed nature of what might be occurring with other types of practices. But what it's actually strengthening, I don't know. That's what I was saying. What might it be undoing functionally in the brain? So I just think there's a lot more questions to ask. And also, how practical is it to get folks that have zero experience or exposure or even interest in mindfulness to want to do these kinds of practices?
If we find that they are
incredibly useful, getting them in more direct contact with the actual nature of how the mind works and how reality works in some sense.
You know, not many people have experience in mindfulness directly, even given its popularity, but almost everyone has a lot of experience suffering psychologically. I mean, that's a very wide door for people. And if people can just become interested in the mechanics of how they feel less than happy. I mean, everyone knows what it's like to feel, or I mean, most everyone knows what it's like to feel at ease and relaxed and like they don't have an immediate problem to solve. And if they just pay a little bit of attention, they can notice how often they're shifted from that condition into some sort of long emergency, which in retrospect almost never seems to have been worth it. This actually links to what I want to ask you about now as we get to the end of our conversation. Your interest in this topic, as we pointed out, predates the smartphone and social media, but everything you've been studying is now all too relevant to a much wider range of people, given the ubiquitous sense that our engagement with technology has effectively become some kind of ghastly psychological experiment to which no one consented, right? I mean, we're driving ourselves crazy with how we're relating to information and the tools by which we're doing that. What are your thoughts? I mean, I'm thinking of, the work of Jonathan Haidt and other people now, especially with, what's happened to the influence of smartphones and social media on our kids. How do you think about our engagement with information and information technology? And what, if anything, are you doing in your own research to focus on that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I'm thinking about it quite a bit. We haven't actually started a formal research program around it, but in every single project we do, it comes up. And there is sort of an organic movement toward, oh, can I apply this in my relationship with my phone? And I would say I have a couple of thoughts. So the first is, yes, we have to accept that not only have we not consented, but that there's an economic model that is benefiting from this experiment that is unfolding. And nobody's really representing the participant side of things, right? I mean, we're just in the middle of it. So responsibility and some kind of oversight regarding how to protect attention as the commodity that is being sold, it's going to have to happen because we need it. And we're up against a lot, teams of engineers that have just finely tuned and really have just so precisely pushed all the buttons to maximize engagement and ignoring any attempt to disengage from social media, for example. So there has to be something that something will happen and is starting. People are starting to talk about this more formally. But the other thing is sort of what we're not talking about. So yes, we're talking about, we're driving ourselves crazy. We're always on social media, et cetera. What we're not talking about as much is what are the costs of not having mental white space that you might have had if you were standing in line at the grocery store, not looking on your phone. And, it's almost like it's the other side of mind wandering. Whereas mind wandering, we talked about as off-task thoughts during some kind of ongoing task that you have that are problematic. They lead to more errors, they lead to missed information, et cetera. The other side of mind wandering in some sense, which is part of the same sort of family of phenomenon, is arising of spontaneous thought. So when spontaneous thought is self-related and occurs in the context of you're trying to get something else done, that's what we'd call mind wandering. Sort of mental meandering that emerges spontaneously and not constrained by I'm trying to do something else can be extremely beneficial. And we know this. We know this from studies in which people are literally like, go for a walk and let your mind meander.
Yeah.
We are losing those moments. And I do think that there's a bigger drain on our flourishing and functioning because we are not actively allowing that white space of mental meandering to be part of our lives. So, and then in terms of practical solutions for this, as it relates to attention, simply deciding you're going to do a digital detox or throw your phone away. I mean, these are just incredibly impractical. So I think other solutions are going to have to happen. And that's why I was saying in many of our studies, we'll say you can relate focusing, noticing, redirecting to the moments in which you are using your phone. So picking up the phone with an intention, what's my goal of how I want to interact with this device? What is the purpose of my picking it up? And then moment by moment, what app you're clicking on, what you're looking at, like constantly keeping meta awareness online as you are engaging with this, with some sort of policies that say, once I'm done and I've achieved my goal, I will put this down. That itself takes a lot of cognitive energy to do, but it's in some sense, the only way we probably have to empower ourselves given the current attention economy. And then doing all the simple things like turn off all your notifications, don't use and allow yourself to be prompted other than what is necessary, because it is costing you. You are spending out this precious brain resource with every intended or unintended engagement.
Yeah. I mean, one point I think I should make that may have gotten lost is that The goal of mindfulness of any sort is not to suppress thought, right? I mean, there are meditation practices, you know, classically concentration practices, wherein the goal actually is to pay such close attention to an object so that thoughts no longer arise, right? And that can be, you know, very, very pleasant and very drug-like and wonderful, but those are, you know, temporary experiences, however long they last. Mindfulness is just a matter of noticing whatever is appearing in experience, including thoughts, right? So thoughts can become objects of mindfulness. And so you're not just, I don't want people to get the sense that mindfulness itself is antithetical to what you just called, I think, cognitive white space, right? I mean, it's its own form of white space. And I think one routinely finds that in meditation practice, many very creative and interesting and useful thoughts can arise, you know, and some people keep a notepad so that they can just write them down and no longer have to think them, you know, or obsess about them in that, you know, session of sitting or on retreat. But, you know, however good you get at meditation, it's not that you're going to think much, much less. You're just simply going to have a different relationship 100%. To thoughts. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. The goal, I mean, the reason I mentioned off task, on task is because when we're not in a mindfulness practice mode, and let's say we're writing an email or reading a book, there are things we're trying to get done or perform surgery, for example. And when thoughts arise, we do need to wonder and at least interrogate whether it's appropriate to go in that direction of using our mental mode. So yeah, 100% agree with you. And that we don't, are not attempting to contrive any particular valence to what we're experiencing. We're not practicing mindfulness with the idea of only having happy thoughts. In fact, doing that we know is very cognitively draining when the circumstances don't necessarily, you know, enable that all that easily.
Hmm. Oh, one thing I did, which didn't take much cognitive overhead, it actually just took a second, but it took me a long time to decide to do this, was I just deleted my Twitter account, which had an enormous impact on my life. I mean, it was just incredible. You know, it might not be practical for some people to do that, but given how I was using Twitter and how Twitter was using me, it was much better to delete it than to simply be mindful of the resultant chaos in my life of, you know, having the account and checking it, you know, dozens of times a day.
I'm so proud of you. You famously did that. And I think freeing up your own cognitive bandwidth, but giving the example of how other people could be empowered to do the same.
I remain embarrassed as to what a life hack that proved to be. It was quite incredible. Yeah. So, well, Amishi, it's been great to finally get you here on the podcast. It's, you know, we obviously share many interests here. And at some point I will let you put however many EEG leads you have on my head. Maybe we'll do that when I lose all of my hair. It'll be very easy.
I don't want to comment on that, but we want you to come by because I think it would be very cool. Also want to just thank you because what you are doing and offering through these conversations is up-leveling the kind of students I have come to my lab. And
nice.
I think that you'd be giving back by adding to science in this way.
So it'd be fun.
Make a trip to Miami.
Yeah. Should I go to Miami, I will definitely let you know. So, Amishi, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. This is a lot of fun.